Only 7 women have democratically won the right to represent their communities in Papua New Guinea's national parliament. Right now, there are none. But this June, the people of Papua New Guinea will go to the polls to decide who will represent them, and it's hoped that that number will change. Hello, and welcome to the AusPNG Network's Women in Politics series, a Lowy Institute podcast where we talk about Papua New Guinea's pressing issues for women seeking greater political representation. My name is Jessica Collins, and I'm a research fellow here at the Institute. And I'm very excited to welcome my guest today, Dame Carol Kidu, who successfully served for 3 terms in Papua New Guinea's parliament and who has been on the ground helping women to get elected themselves. Dame Carol, welcome and hello.
Hi.
Carol, I'm just going to set the scene here of your story because it is absolutely remarkable. You survived 3 terms in a parliament where 40 to 50% of incumbents typically lose their seat at every election. You were granted a ministry and held onto it for 9 years, and at one point, you were the first female opposition leader and also the only person in opposition. Rumours also have it that you were offered deputy prime minister, but you turned it down. This is a massive and impressive career in a parliament that struggles to get women elected. So let's start first with just how you managed to do it. How did you get elected and how did you break through those barriers that for so long have held women back?
Okay, I think it's best to say there were many things to my advantage which people did not actually realise. I know the diplomatic circles used to think, what on earth does she think she's doing, you know? But they didn't know anything about my personal life. My personal life is not spent in expatriate circles or in the well-to-do circles because my late husband's village is right here in the capital city. It's an urban village. And so there's no way I could be living in a bubble. Our whole life was built around village activities, village commitments and obligations. I had that on my side, which many people did not realize how deeply involved I was in all of those things. I think as well as that, there's no doubt that my husband's death, because he was a highly respected person, and the country lost a very good person when they lost Buri, and his death, there was that element of the sympathy vote. And I would never have stood for politics, ever, except as a result of Buri's death. And so there was that sympathy vote. In fact, being an outsider and being white-skinned was used against me to a small degree, but it was more to my advantage than to my disadvantage because people made comments. When I did campaign speeches in Mortu language in villages, and I heard elders behind the area talking together saying, "Iyo baita votia," yes, let's vote for her. But in Ibi Nauhahine, she's a white lady. She knows these. She's a European. She knows these things. To Bemeite Dahine, Lasibona Lasi Vaitani. But if it's our women, no way, no way, no way. And when I was trying very hard after the 2007 election, which I thought would bring some women in, because it was our first past the post, the first limited preferential voting, when I was working on the reserve seats, affirmative action of various sorts, I had some colleagues who were supporting me very strongly, saying, "You must keep at this, Carol, because if not, there'll be 50 years before we really get women into parliament." But I had other colleagues who would say to me, "Oh, Carol, we don't mind you being here, but we don't want our own women in here." Right? I mean, what an indictment. And it shows the discrimination, the disadvantage that Papua New Guinean Indigenous women have in trying to go into politics. So there were many factors in my favour. And to win again and again, well, I worked very, very hard. I knew that I wouldn't win again on a sympathy vote. So I worked hard at the ground level because that was my interest area, working on the ground with the people, introducing programs that could assist in communities at grassroots level. I wasn't a big project type politician. My successor, he is a big project type politician doing big things. I was more a people politician. And I mean, there's a space for both of them in politics. That's what helped me to win again and again. I had early childhood programs going. I had set up an organization called Guinea Go, a business development that was training for the marginalized who weren't in the formal system. I had special committees for HIV. I had a lot of extra things, an organization called Eda Māori, which raised funds to help pay school fees for children. And so, you know, it was my deep involvement at community level that helped me win again and again.
Carol, I'm really pleased that you brought up your husband. Sir Burikidu was a local legend and a very successful man and well-respected, as you said. He was knighted because he was the first Indigenous Chief Justice of Papua New Guinea. We've heard the term before, legacy candidate, and you just brought up the sympathy vote. Are those two things linked? And what are your views of being a legacy candidate? And did you think that that fitted within your experience as well?
I don't know that I have views on it. But after Buri was not reappointed to the judiciary after there'd been quite a bit of upheaval and the cabinet under its discretion by our law appoints the Chief Justice, and they're not appointed for life like I believe in Australia they are, the judges. They do a three-year first term and then they do 10 years at a time. So Buri had done 3 years and a 10-year. He was not particularly liked by the governments of the day. He was, because he was extremely strong on independence of the judiciary. So he was not reappointed. That brought a great outcry and a lot of people coming to him, asking him to stand for politics. And I said to him, look, I don't think you're going to be able to avoid it. He said, oh, well, why don't you bloody well do it? And I thought, you know, gee, I think he cursed me with that. But after his death, I kind of felt this stupid gut anger that he'd died so young. And he never got to answer the people. He used to say, come back in 6 months and I'll give you an answer. And he never got to answer the people. But I did find some letters in his records where he had actually written to a friend in response to a friend in Australia, had said, I believe I will probably stand for politics. So he had kind of made the decision in his mind, although he'd never made it public here. And after his death, well, people like the late Sir Cecil Abel and people like that used to say to me, Carol, it can't end here. And they kind of urged me on. And so I had this madness of, I'd do it. I have no background in politics. I had never voted until I voted for myself because Buri made a point of not voting. Because he just did not want to identify politically with anyone or any party or anything. So he never voted in his life as a judge. So it was kind of, I had a fire in my belly and a lot of anger in me about certain things at the time. But I had to go through a long process of getting permission from the elders and from the clan and family and things like that. And talking, the elders, of course, spoke to Buri at his grave and things like that, to be able to stand with family approval. I would never have done it without family approval.
So you were born in Queensland, and the question may have been raised about your being an outsider to the community. So how did that impact on your being accepted by the community to run for election?
I didn't consider myself an outsider to the community. And I don't know, they always saw me as, and now Hahinea, a European lady, but I think I earned my space in the family very much. I went to the gardens with the women. I went shellfishing with the women. I did all the activities that women do, as well as teaching during the week to earn money to help Buri support the family with basic needs. I had well and truly earned my place in the family and in Motu society, and I was known for that, although the expatriate and the well-off community had no idea of my personal life.
So 1997 was the first year that you ran for election. Was money politics a problem then?
Not really. I mean, yeah, it's expensive to campaign in Papua New Guinea, but money politics in the sense of buying votes hadn't really emerged too much at that stage. By my third campaign, it was emerging, this new style of politics called big bank politics and money politics. and tribal politics. In the early campaigns, no, that wasn't so strong. And you still had to raise considerable money. So I'm lucky that I'm in the capital city. I could have some fundraisings with corporate sector. I mean, my first time round, people thought I was crazy. They couldn't imagine how I could think I would have a place in Parliament. But I think I earned their respect once I got there, because I made a point of doing things that I knew I could be noticed for. And I made a point of using the processes of Parliament to get my voice out there, even though I was in opposition or whatever, even though I was not in favour and I had to, you know, fight for everything in the beginning. There are processes in Parliament that you can use to get your voices heard, you know, with matters of public importance, using grievance debate and doing a press release with it. So I made sure I used the processes that I could to be heard. And I probably passed more private members' legislation than anyone's ever done in Parliament. In that first year when I was in the opposition, which I made a very distinct decision to be in the opposition, that I to be not take a ministry if it was offered to me. When the vote of no confidence came and there was a change in leadership, I wasn't interested in a ministry, but I knew what I wanted to bargain for. And so I bargained to head a special parliamentary committee on urbanisation and social development. So I was quite strategic in many ways. This gave me as much exposure in many ways as a minister, in that I was calling consultative meetings, getting media to them on an increasingly complex issue. And yet I didn't have that pressure of being a minister when I was so green in politics, because I didn't know anything about politics.
And what about Hanmark? We've heard about the contributions, the evidence of contributions that candidates have to show to their community when they're running for election. Was that also something that you had to do when you were first campaigning?
To a certain degree, yes. People like to know those things, but not as much as now. And, of course, the incumbents now can have plenty of Hanmark because they have the politicised monies that are now part of politics in PNG, so they have the means to leave Hanmark. I could point out that I'd established the Suburi Kidu Heart Institute, that I'd been a member of YWCA, that I'd done various things. I don't know that people were very interested in that, possibly, but Hanmark, yeah, and I think my Hanmark was that I spoke Motu language. I had to suddenly learn to speak pidgin because I'm not a great fan of pidgin. Great language for communication in country, but it does concern me now that pidgin just dominates everywhere and even grade 12 students are not comfortable speaking English. I've found this as I've moved around recently doing the work I'm doing, when some grade 12 students and even tertiary students said to me, oh, do you mind if we answer in pidgin? We'd prefer to answer in pidgin. And I was horrified. You know, and if I was back in Parliament now, I'd be making that a grievance debate and a matter of public importance, that pidgin is dominating now, and it doesn't introduce our children to the global society. And so, you know, to me, it's quite concerning. I make a point now, I don't speak to my grandchildren in Motu. My Motu is deteriorated because I speak to them only in English so that they're hearing English all the time, because the rest of the time they're hearing Motu in pidgin.
That's a really interesting perspective on the universalisation of language in Papua New Guinea. Carol, it's been a decade since you were in office. You've talked about the increase of money politics, and you've also talked about the increase of using Hanmark to show evidence of your contribution to community.
Increase of violence and intimidation. Definitely, that's increased as well. Violence and intimidation.
And is that ubiquitous, or is it, you know, just is it in urban areas or in rural areas?
Yeah, urban areas are very, very mixed areas. It's in certain rural areas in the upper highlands, certainly violence and domination is very strong, and tribal voting. In the urban areas, that conceptual framework has been brought in from people from outside. But if you go into other areas, the elections basically run the way they should, except that often the rolls are not completed. I've just found out I'm not on the roll anymore. I don't know where I've gone to, and about half the people in my community here somehow are not on the roll. and got 2 weeks or something to try to get that sorted out.
Let's talk about tribal voting. We haven't had that concept brought up yet. So can you just explain the key characteristics of that?
Well, in some parts of Papua New Guinea, this is getting into very complex things. In some parts of Papua New Guinea, jealousy is very strong in communities. In the Papuan, in the coastal areas in general, jealousy is quite strong. And in the lower highlands. But in the upper highlands, jealousy, it's not jealousy so much, it's pride. And that being proud of a leader, and people will do anything to support their leader, even if they're lousy leaders, they'll support them because they're so proud of leadership. There's pride. And I am apprehensive about the coming elections, that there will be violence and bloodshed in certain areas. But in other areas, the election will go through as the way it should. People will just line up as usual, get a bit angry when they find their name is missing from the roll, but they won't turn to violence. So the tribal voting, they will tend to commandeer the box. I mean, it's unthinkable in Australia. Commandeer the box and just fill in all the ballot papers and put them in the box. And so an individual who may be wanting to make a different vote has very little chance to do it, because maybe one person is stuffing the box, the ballot papers in the box. And there are, you know, guns and things. Now, I want to make it clear that this is not all over Papua New Guinea. This is just in a few areas. In most areas, the elections will go through reasonably peacefully, I would think, the same as always. There'll be dissatisfaction because the rolls, there has not been enough money to really do a good job of having completed rolls. But people will just accept that with a resigned thing. If that's the way it is, I'll be resigned to it. Yeah, so I want to make clear that this tribal vote and the block voting, they call it, is only in certain areas and certainly not the majority of the country. But it is a problem because it has been introduced to some of the urban areas as well. There's another custom that's been introduced of having campaign houses, or they're called cell houses, and already campaign houses or cell houses are going up around the country, and your supporters sit inside those places, like building up support, and you're expected to give them coffee and tea and food for months during the campaign period. I'm hoping that if we get some women in, they will fight to make them illegal. They only started in my final term in politics, and that final campaign. And I kept saying, no, I will not set up a cell house. It's not the way it's supposed to be done. It's like a way of trapping in your voters. And in the end, in the very last week, I said, they came begging me, please, people are leaving us because you haven't got a cell house and we can't drink tea and coffee together. It gets to that level, you know, of feeling. And so I said, okay, well, on the day of the voting, I'll send out your blue canvases to sit under as my supporters. When you have here, it's a custom that you feed people after the voting. It's just a custom, you know, it's always done. And you send food out to the area. And so I had to compromise in the end, because people were leaving me to go and sit in someone else's cell house and be fed. You know, it's quite sad. And so a person without the means to fundraise, and I won the election, but I had debts to pay off, you know, afterwards. The people without the financial backup, it's extremely hard nowadays. And people expect to be fed, they expect to be given money for their votes now quite often. And so I'm out there now really strongly campaigning against that. But I've made a commitment to some of the women that I will actually go out and campaign with them. Australian National University identified the highest scorers in the 2017 election, the ones who came in the top five, some of them, and I contacted them all. They asked me to go and work with them. It's the first time I've been involved in politics since I left. When I left politics, retired by choice, I said I'd never go back in. I'd had enough of it. But I feel the thing is, the situation is just so untenable now with no women in politics, that I felt I should make some commitment. And so I've been traveling out with some identified women into communities. It's a very fine line. I'm not allowed to campaign, but there is clearly what is campaigning and what is not campaigning. I'm doing awareness about the importance of women in politics, about the fact that traditionally women did have power. but it was a power in the private sphere. And it was the men who did the oratory. And we have to move away from that because we're not in traditional times when we're in national parliament. I just do a really lot of very simple stuff on the ground that can capture the minds of illiterate people. But unfortunately, I think it's too little too late now. It only started in September last year. And so it's not enough to have major impact. I've been doing some nationwide broadcast work through NBC as well. But, I mean, to do this properly, we will need to start after this coming election and work right through until 2027 and work towards the 2024 LLG elections, local level government elections as well. And we've got to make that our targets all the way along, because there needs to be broad-based community education and working on changing mindsets about politics. But the interesting thing is that our first election after independence, six women stood and three won. Half of them won, you know. And so in many ways, we've gone back drastically.
Yeah, that's something that I wanted to touch on a bit later in our conversation today. But let's just focus on now on your time in Parliament. For over a decade, you were the only woman in Parliament. So what was that like for you?
It was all right. I don't see myself as a woman. I just see myself as a person, not a woman. And I don't focus on this woman thing, and that's why I'm encouraging women, don't focus on the fact that you're a woman. Focus on the fact that you're a person with the skills you need to go in that are needed. And being a woman gives you some extra special skills that men don't have as well. But don't make a big focus on that. The only issue is that when you're doing contentious work, you know, it's pretty hard sometimes to get enough people backing up what you're doing. Although I'm not convinced women would have backed up some of the work I was doing in my last term. I left my really contentious things till my last term. I did major reforms to the sexual abuse, rape legislation in my first term as a private member. When I look back now, I think, my God, how did I do that? It's phenomenal. And I think it was partly that I was Sir Burry's widow, that people just respected me and let me go ahead and do what I was doing. But I did get through major reform to the sexual legislation, changes in the rape laws, changing in the evidence for proving rape and things like that. But in my final term, I took on two contentious issues that I really wanted to have an impact on, but I couldn't succeed in those. I couldn't get them out of cabinet onto the floor. And I don't think women would have supported me even if there were women with me. And they were the areas of human rights issues, the areas of the fact that sex workers are still criminals in Papua New Guinea. And, you know, it's not a suitable way to address issues. It should be addressed as a social and a health issue, not as a moral issue. And also the area that, you know, gay and sexual diversity is actually illegal in Papua New Guinea. We have the 1600s British law, which came through the Queensland Criminal Code and has been changed everywhere else, but we are still hanging on to those laws about unnatural offences. My colleagues said to me, some of my good colleagues who supported me on, and were supporting me on that too, but they said, why are you bothering, Carol? The laws are not used. But the fact is the laws were abused, and police used to blackmail sex workers and gay fellows, threatening them with arrest if they didn't give them money and things like that. Not all police, but some. And I used to say, no, if a law is being abused, we have to get rid of it. But I didn't succeed, and there's been one attempt since I left politics to work on the sex work area, but it just had no traction at all. I thought it would. It was a man putting it forward, but no traction, and we still can't touch those things that are seen as sinful and moral judgments being made on them.
There's certainly a lot to be proud of during your time in office, and I think one of them was introducing the reserve seating legislation, or the bill to Parliament, the temporary special measures. And clearly that's a conversation that needs to continue, given that there are no women currently serving in Parliament. During this series, we've heard a different perspective on this. She's a candidate in an urban area, and she said that men and women need to start on an even playing field if they are to respect each other and reach true equality in Parliament. So what do you think about this perspective, and just how temporary would the special measures be if they were introduced into Parliament?
Well, number one, they're not likely to be introduced. There's no appetite for them. They're not likely to be introduced. There are certainly things for and against reserve seats. But the fact is, with no women there, we need to have some form of affirmative action possibly. And if we don't get any women in this time round, there's got to be a strong lobby to bring some in under Section 101 and Section 102 of our Constitution. There is a provision for appointed seats, which I don't like, appointed seats. And now the first stage of the reserve seat was passed. So there is the platform there to put in some form of reservation, not the original one, but there is no appetite for it amongst the men. And so it's going to be very difficult to have it passed. I certainly don't support the idea of appointing women and just having, you know, they've got to go in by some process of election, even if it's a seat by reservation. And, you know, I know people say it's not an equal, they should go in on an equal playing field. And I know a lot of people say that, but it's not an equal playing field. Section 50 of our Constitution says that guarantees opportunity to stand for public office. And yeah, equal opportunity to stand for public office is there. Anyone can stand. But equal opportunity to win? No way. No way. That's a long way away in PNG. And so it's not an equal playing field. And so there are real issues here, but there is little appetite for it. And so we could end up with a parliament with no women again. We could end up a parliament with two or three women. To think that we might get 20 women in, I think that's really stretching it. But that's what we need. We need 20, we need a good group of, a solid group of women in there. And the ones I've been working with, I've said, once you're in, you must form a women's caucus. I think there's a good chance we'll get, I know the ones I'm working with that have been identified by ANU, I think there is a good chance for perhaps 3 out of the 8, but maybe more. There's some that are not in the identified group because they did not stand in 2017, but I've heard of several that I think may have a chance. But you've got to rely also on the system working honestly and properly at the end too. And what happens in the counting room, et cetera, is also very, very important. I do believe we'll have some women in after these elections. I certainly hope we will.
This pre-election period, we have seen some remarkable progress in political parties. In one party, only women were chosen as the 4 candidates in their national capital district seats. And a major party last year elected its first female as the national president of the party. These are big steps in the right direction, but how do we make sure that the progress continues? Do you think there is space to mandate quotas in political parties?
It would be nice, perhaps. Yeah, it would be nice. But there are a multiplicity of ways that affirmative action is used globally. And I don't see mandating quotas in parties, except for individual parties doing it, which I think some might do, but certainly not as a broad-based law. I don't see that happening, being accepted to acceptable by some parties. I think, as you say, there's been this move towards endorsing women, and we hope it's more than lip service.
So let's turn now to what's happening during this election. And just to set the scene, in 2017, there were record numbers of women running for parliament. So that was around 150 women, but they totaled only 5% of the candidacy because there were 3,340 candidates standing for that election. So that's a massive pool of candidates for just 111 seats. Now, this year, there's 7 new electorates that have been added to this election, taking the number of seats up to 118. So what does that mean for the numbers of women that will be standing this year? Do you think we'll have those record numbers again? And you said before that you think we're going to hopefully get a couple of them successful. What's your view?
I've been encouraging women, even if you have no chance. Most men have no chance. if you are interested to stand and you have a strong desire to stand, just stand. Don't waste your money. Don't do that, but just nominate, do the best you can, experience a campaign, because very few people win on their first election anyway, their first campaign anyway. Most people take several campaigns before they actually win. And I'm hoping we'll see several hundred women this time, not just 135. I want to see quite a number of women, because I want that statement to be made very clearly. We want a space in Parliament. We deserve a space in Parliament. And by standing, they are making that statement. As you said rightly, the men, there was over 3,000, stood, and well, most of them lose. So I don't know why we have to focus so much on the fact that women are losing. You know, the men stand and they lose, and women stand and they lose, and the men stand against each other. We get women standing against each other, and I encourage them to cooperate with each other, to see that they are fighting a common problem in PNG, that not see the other women as their enemies, but see that, you know, we're fighting a common cause, and cooperate rather than conflict.
So you mentioned before that you need to do, or there needs to be a lot of community awareness and advocacy programs to better prepare the community to vote for women and men in the election, to really make their vote count. Do you think that the Australian government has a role in this? You mentioned before that they particularly help up until the time of the issue of the writs. Do you think that there's a role for them or any other government or development organisation in doing that sort of ongoing community awareness programs?
I'm hoping after these elections, because I don't think there'll be spectacular change come up with these elections, I'm hoping that they will continue to support this type of work of community awareness, because it has been done by Caritas and Transparency International. What I would like to see, and of course UN Women, as well as Australian National University, UNDP with their mock parliaments, although I personally think, well, why women have mock parliaments? Why don't men have mock parliaments? You know, they don't have any more knowledge before they go in than women do. I find mock parliaments a little bit farcical. I used to do mock parliaments as a member, but for the youth in my electorate, and trying to get the youth to understand politics. I find it a bit strange. Why should women have mock parliaments and not men? Because once you go in, when you do get in there, there are induction programs are run by the parliamentary staff, and you have to learn on the job pretty quickly. And that's where I would like women to be in a women's caucus, so it's not such a struggle as I found, because I went in with a completely blank head, and I had to do a lot of very rapid learning, and I never did master it all. It's something you learn on the job in a way, the actual inside politics. But I'm hoping that we can design a program that is an integrated program, bringing together the work being done by various organisations. PNG government will not fund it, I'm pretty convinced of that. So we would be looking for development partner money to fund it. And starting from broad-based community awareness, civic education, going to another level of focusing on women interested in politics and candidates, and then going to another level of the newly established Academy for Women in Politics at the Pacific Institute of Law and Governance, or whatever it's called, PILAG, which used to be the Admin College. And so it's like a tiered progress, where many will just be doing the lower tier to broaden their knowledge of what it's all about, and some will go through until they go to this political academy for women, which they have in some universities and places overseas as well, where women can go and get training. Women at all levels of politics. At present, I think we tend to be still rather scattergunned. We are donor-driven, because we have to be, because they're the only ones putting money into it. But I am very grateful for the program I'm working on at present, extremely grateful, because it's the first time that they've allowed flexibility for me to design my own program. I mean, and that's an unthinkable thing, really, in development partner work. You usually have to stick to a set design. And I've been saying for a long time, those set designs are nice, but they're not going to help women ring campaigns. They help women improve their knowledge of politics and things, and there's a space for those. But we have to get a huge mindset change going in this country, and that's a different thing. So, yeah, I hope there is a lot that could be done on general civic education. I've been astounded as I go out at the lack of knowledge out there in community now. There's just a vacuum. And people are saying, we've never had this type of awareness before. And they're wanting more. But and I think it is the way to go, but it has to be done comprehensively over a five-year period, not just a few months before an election. It's been a good pilot. It's been a good experiment. It's been a good trial type thing. Lots of learning in it, and we'll be writing a very thorough report from it and recommendations. And I've been focusing as much on the coordinators as on the candidates. They're coordinators in the communities and people, not just the candidate.
Really important work, Carol. What about issues like the, needing considerable amounts of money to travel around an electorate, security issues that you raised before? Are there ways that we can address that in the coming years?
Well, if someone's interested in doing politics in 2027, they should start fundraising from now, if it's women, because it takes a lot of money to run a campaign in PNG, and that's without buying votes. To get around in some of the electorates, it's impossible. And some of the incumbents have access to helicopters and things to fly in and out. And the women are walking mountains and things. It's horrifically difficult, probably incomprehensible to someone in Australia, how difficult it is. I mean, I travelled up, and it was an easy one, actually. I travelled up 4 hours in a canoe up a river to get up to a village in Upper Mekio on the border with Gwilala. And even that travel was very expensive. You have to hire the canoes, you have to hire all the fuel, enormously expensive, the fuel to get large canoes up the river. It needs a lot of money. Just the logistics of a campaign is extremely expensive, and that's what puts women at an enormous disadvantage. Even when they're backed by parties, many parties actually don't have much money to put out there, and they put them out on their sure winners. They put the money out on the ones most likely. In general, women are not seen as winners, so very little money is spent on them, and so it leaves them really struggling unless they can make partnerships and hitch on things with men. And get a ride on a helicopter with a male candidate and things like that. And that's what they need to work on. I was very lucky. I had an urban electorate. I could get in my little old Suzuki and drive from one end of my electorate to the other in a day. Very different kettle of fish from someone who's covering huge expanses of rural areas, remote villages, no real internet connections, anything like that. It's very, very difficult.
It's huge challenges to be surmounted there, absolutely. Carol, we've covered a lot of ground here. You mentioned before that you had a message to women candidates to just stand up. Would you like to expand on that? We'd love to hear one final message to women that are considering standing for election in Papua New Guinea.
And to men. I don't just talk to women. I talk to men. Global experience, global research has all shown the value of having women in parliament. Huge value. You compare with nations that are led by female prime ministers, nations that have a large percentage of women in parliament, their development index and their corruption index in general, but almost more than in general, their development index is better, their corruption index is lower. And I think we have to emphasize that PNG will be a better country with women in politics. But the message is just go out there and keep at it. Know that the odds are very difficult. Know that you're disadvantaged by financial constraints. Know all of those things, but just try to do it. And if you really want to be in politics, you've got to keep close to the people unless you have the means to buy your way into politics and buying people. And to me, sorry, there's a lot going on here. To me, it's not the way that we want our women to be going. So Papua New Guinea is a nation based on relationships. And if you nurture relationships, often that will get you into politics. I nurtured relationships. But on the other hand, once you nurture relationships, those people expect something from you. And it can be a very, very demanding job. And so they have to take care of themselves as well. Because the expectations from the electorate now, since this money politics, have gone in a funny direction. The expectations from the electorate.
Dame Carol Kadu, thank you so much for that message for aspiring candidates. And add that to the story of your career that you shared with us today, and I have no doubt there'll be many women and men spurred into standing up to be elected, like you did. Thank you so much for taking the time to discuss such an important topic with me today. We wish you all the very best as you help women during the election and into the future. You've been listening to the AusPNG Network's Women in Politics series, a Lowy Institute podcast developed with production assistance from Josh Godding. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to joining you next time.